I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello and welcome to Dream Job Ready. My name is Dane Sharp, I'm your host, and my guest for this episode is Aaron Young, CEO and founder of the new and exciting broadcast media platform, Ticker.
Please note that the opinions of guests are their own and not those of the companies they have worked for.
G'day Aaron, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Dream Job Ready. Firstly, for those that haven't listened or got the Ticker app, I'd love you just to give us a quick spiel about the business and how you got started with Ticker.
Yeah, Dane, thanks so much and congratulations on everything you're doing as well. Ticker is basically, we say the business of, and then we finish it. So it could be the business of weddings, it could be the business of news, it could be the business of media, and on it goes. It actually started off, it was going to be kind of this under 45s channel talking about the markets and business. And then I thought, well, I think that there's this huge crowd on LinkedIn. There's this huge group of people talking about skills and news and just so much. And that's what we kind of merged into. So where we began 7 months ago, I knew, and even when we basically ticked record for the very first day, that it would continue to evolve into what people needed, not what we thought they needed. So we have all sorts of shows from how to handle a crisis in your career and personal life, we call it the 30 Life Crisis. She's the Boss about females. We have news programs at 8 in the morning, 10 in the morning, 2 p.m. in the afternoon. They kind of talk about startups and founders and entrepreneurs and the business community and news. So it's really trying to not mimic the 6 p.m. news as such or news channels that exist, but to give Australians a bit of a broader conversation about what's happening in the economy that isn't just what's happening on the stock market. So I think that's the best way to sum it up.
Now, that's awesome, mate. And you know, it's such a timely opportunity for you as well, right? You obviously didn't predict the year 2020 and the amount of varied news we were going to have, but you know, it must be exciting for you, I suppose, to be have launched a business like this and be able to kind of convey these stories and tell these stories to different people that are keen to tune in different ways.
Yeah, well, there were three main events really over the past essentially 20 years that we remember. There's 9/11 in 2001. There was Hurricane Katrina, of course, it happened in about 2006. And then there was also the GFC that happened in 2008, 2009. And when I think back to 2008, I had just started working for Sky not so long earlier, and the GFC happened just as we launched a business channel that I've been seconded over to. And to think of, I was learning about finance news as the world's economy is collapsing, was a really interesting experience. And I've been able to take a lot of the lessons from what it was like going through that into this. I was working in Russia, a company called Russia Today, just as it was launching when Hurricane Katrina was happening as well. And there we are in Russia kind of dealing with all these stories. And the biggest story is happening over there and how you kind of cope when the story isn't impacting you right here, but it's happening elsewhere. And obviously COVID-19 is everywhere here and overseas. And then it reminds me of the anxiety I had as an 18-year-old journalist getting my first job at a local newspaper not so long before September 11 happened in 2001. And I remember being up all night watching this coverage from around the world, knowing that the next morning I had to go to Rosebud Hospital to take photos of newborns and their parents, which was my job in journalism at the time, not covering these massive stories. And so journalism really, and I think those experiences give you an idea of where my head's at, which is stories, there's no point telling someone anything. We don't work that way. Everybody consumes news that talks to them in their circumstance. And that's how we look at things at Ticker. We have about 30 or 40 different programs at the moment, many of them focusing on COVID-19 in one way or another, but in every way, every show talks to a different sector, a different niche about how things are impacting them.
You've obviously had a long and a very successful career in media, and you know, in this chat, we'll dance through a few different roles and dream jobs you've had, because you know you've worked for some great companies and even tried you know, your own businesses previous to this when you were just getting started out. But just really quickly, staying on Ticker for the minute, you know, what is your staffing like? If you've got that many shows now and it's grown that quickly, how do you staff Ticker? Are you working with full-time employees? Have you got contractors? How does the talent work? Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, we are a small business to start with, and I have been, you know, working at Foxtel and sadly seeing what's happening there, the transition that's happened in the media over the past few years, where a lot of full-timers are out the door and it's casuals and contractors coming forward, because businesses really want that flexibility. We're no different. So when we began, it was just me every day, and I was doing absolutely everything from presenting shows to, if we brought on other shows, I'd have to do that as well. Then we brought in a business partner, a wonderful guy who was able to assist us, who's now becoming our commercial director, Jeff Vitale, and he helped with the programs too, so it was the two of us. And then we went, well, we need more shows, because eventually we want to be a channel that has 17 hours a day of content, and we'll die if we do that. And when I talk about it all happening organically, well, that's what I mean. We would have guests who would come in who I would go, you're a great guest. You know your topic really well. How would you feel about doing a show? So that happened with Jules Brook, who then went on to become the host of She's the Boss, and Dr. Steve Endicott, who went on to become the host of 30 Life Crisis. And one by one, people would start coming to us, or they'd see on LinkedIn what was happening, and they would come to us. I'll tell you, I've never had to make a single call. I've never had to go out and search for people right from the very beginning. And I think that tells you that you're on the right thing. It's been, there's a saying, never chase a girl. And that's been what's happened with us. We haven't had to chase. It's been the other way around, which tells us there was a huge hunger and desire for the sort of stuff we're doing. But we got to the stage late last year where we were kind of calling on mates to help us out and things like that. And it was just because you got to get the revenue right. I never wanted us to be this kind of Silicon Valley company like Uber or WeWork that can lose billions of dollars but somehow be deemed a success because they've created disaster in an established industry. Of course you want to disrupt, you have to disrupt. But I don't think that in Australia we have the same kind of mentality of disrupt and lose money. It's disrupt and make money, otherwise you're not going to be around for very long. So everything we did was based on making sure that if we did something here, we could back it up here. So I call it extend and fulfill. So we extend ourselves where we bring on someone for maybe 4 or 5 hours, and then we fill it up, we fulfill, we make it work so we can get them to that 8 hours. And that's the process that we take. So we have 2 full-time staff, we have 2 casuals who are at about 6 hours a day. We're moving to 8 hours a day. We just kind of, I'm constantly in touch with Jed saying, what can we afford? Where are we at? And that's pretty common. Like I've always immersed myself in the stories of people like Walt Disney. And Walt may have been the face of Walt Disney Studios, but his brother Roy was the guy who allowed him to be the philanthropist, to be the entrepreneur. You've got to have an entrepreneur. You've got to have a great person behind who's your CFO, your commercial director, because entrepreneurs don't generally know much about ticking boxes and making sure stuff's done. It's been about trying to get the foundations right, and we've got that, and now it's about growing.
That's awesome, mate. And that's, you know, I hear you on the 1-2 punch of that leadership. I've seen it in companies I've worked for. The best example was Ripco with its 2 founders, you know, Doug Warbrick and Brian Singer. They were, you know, like-minded people, obviously, to start a business like that together, but they were also so different, yin and yang and black and white at the right time. Oh, so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm the kind of creative guy, and I can't stand doing the finance stuff or calling people up and saying, where's my money? But that's what I need, because I don't like doing it and I can't do it, the business would fall over if I didn't do it. So to bring someone in, and similarly, whenever he tries to do creative, I just stand back with a smirk on my face and say, get out of my office. So, but that's how we work. That's how yin and yang. We're great friends. We get on really well. And that partnership, that team environment, that sense of never making anyone feel like there's hierarchy or anything like that. It's about trying to say, you know as much about your area as I know about my area. And if you tell me it's final in your area, that's fine, so long as you accept the same when I say it in my area, and that's it. We always need to listen to each other. You don't always have all the answers, but it's a humbling experience.
I think it's really really great that it sounds like even though you're a small business, you're starting to already thinking about that culture and building that trust amongst your employees and future employees, which is super important.
It's just about being open. Like, there's no secret squirrel. What's to hide? I sometimes just go into the newsroom where everyone is and I sit in the middle and have a chat with everyone about where we're at, where the business is at, what we're going through, how we're waiting for this to come through or that's fallen through, so that communication. Media companies are famously shocking at communication. I've worked for places where I would find out what's happening in the business through media releases that have gone out everywhere else. And obviously management want to keep things secret and journos have a habit of leaking, and I understand that. But at the same time, it can create a culture of us versus them, of seniority versus slave. And I don't necessarily think that that works. And I think that right now, starting a business as we are, it's great to set off the foundations as a communication business. And when you have a bad day or someone stuffs up, who usually is great, when you go to tell them, hey, there was a problem there, they respect it more because it's not the first time they hear from you. It's not like the relationship is you never hear from your manager unless there's a problem. Yeah. That doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work with the younger generation. And I think that any idea that it's just millennials, well, I just think it was the wrong approach in the first place, to be honest.
And what about the early listeners and audience that you've had? What are the most common pieces of feedback or advice they're sharing upwards to you guys?
Well, the first thing was, how do we watch ticker, right? So people would see things on their LinkedIn that would come up, other people who'd appear on it who they knew. There was their Twitter, etc. And it's very, very, very hard to start a brand. For example, Disney has moved into Disney Plus streaming, and they've got like 100 trillion people who are paid for their service. Why? Well, because they're Disney, they're already known. But if a little Australian production company decided to start a streaming service, how on earth would anyone find out? And so when we first started Ticker, I had a business partner who had just returned from the US, loved the US, loved Silicon Valley, was obsessed with Silicon Valley, and was hoping that Ticker could be something similar to a business called Cheddar. Now, I was aware of Cheddar, and they're kind of this young, hip, as I mentioned, market-driven, telling young people what's happening in the cannabis sectors and Bitcoin. Well, Bitcoin isn't really huge in Australia. And also this idea of build it and they will come in terms of charge for subscription ain't going to work. And I really didn't listen to my gut instinct and wanted to believe that it was the case and went along down that path. But the second we launched a paid service, it was very clear from the early numbers and just that sense that who's going to pay for something they don't know. Sure. And the basic business of... you would spend more on marketing and billboards and social media advertising to get people to come and have a look before they would even pay than you could ever make from your $55 a year subscription. So there was a lot of kind of wasted energy there. But the number one lesson that we learned was being agile and understanding that if it doesn't work, fix it right away at any cost, because otherwise it will sink the business. And so straight away we got rid of the first app. We went to another company that could do four apps, Android and Apple on both iPhone and also on TV. Mm-hmm. And that ability to quickly transfer and to change and to know that we're stuffed unless we do this, I think that driving ambition of whatever it takes, and that's what you need to have.
Now, that's great, mate. And I think that's, you know, I'd love you to build on that a little bit more, because you hear businesses talk about the necessity to be agile. I don't know if a lot of them know the definition still yet, but they talk about it. A lot do, and it sounds like you had to make some quick and hard, fast decisions early to switch that up. Have you had any experience with having to, as a personal endeavor, be quick or be able to move in your career or your job direction?
Oh, so many times. Like, it comes back to sport, doesn't it? I go running and I go bike riding, and you've got that horrible hill And I find that if you look at the top of the hill from the bottom of the hill, it just makes it 100 times worse. Whereas if you keep your eyes down on the ground directly in front of your feet and you're only looking where you are right now and dealing with what's in front of you, not what could be around the corner, it actually helps so much. I look back to a period of my life where I was really unhappy, and that was when, to be honest, I was shifted across to Sky News Business from Sky News, and I didn't know much about business news, and I loved news. And these days I love both, because being a business journo taught me so much about politics and news and how the whole world works. So when I went back, I had a greater understanding of why don't we have enough money to pay everybody? Oh, that's why. That's, you know, that kind of link between the two. But I remember just having the frustration all the time and talking to my manager all the time and going, I want to go back to news. And him going, Aaron, I have so many people who are doing the same thing right now. I don't have time nor any interest. And that is a really good sign of never hassle your boss if you're unhappy. Come up with a way to fix your problem yourself. So we were at Channel 9 at the time. Sky News was based at Channel 9, right next to the studio where A Current Affair was broadcast. And they were moving down to a different studio. And the audio director said to me, would you like these four microphones? And I put them in my backpack riding home. And I'm thinking, because we didn't have much equipment, and I'm thinking, what can I use four microphones for? And it was 2009, ahead of the 2010 state election. And I thought, well, imagine if I did this show each week of the 4 weeks of an election campaign on the banks of the Yarra with me and three guests using those four mics and talking about where we're at and what's coming up, and it could be education, whatever. So as I rode home along the Yarra, I went past the Melbourne Convention Centre and thought, I'll do the show there. So I get home, call them, they say yes. I pitched the show to Sydney, and they're like, yeah, we'll definitely do it. Sounds great. What a great idea. And then the day that we're about to do it, the convention center calls me and says, we can't do this every week. So I call Eureka Tower and say, can we do it there? And they're like, yeah, absolutely. And so I started doing this show about news and politics on my own. So after my day at work at 2 p.m., we go across to Eureka Tower, build the set every single Thursday, everything that comes with that, organize all the guests. We were getting the Lord Mayor, the Premier, the PM at one stage. Just it became this little Melbourne show that I was just doing in my spare time. That then taught management that A, I could change, make a show, get a show happening. I put it all on my credit card. One of the auto cues here is an auto cue that dates back 10 years ago from when I decided to start that show, because I knew that the only way to get yourself out of a problem is to blast yourself out. It's not to complain yourself out. So that kind of, and you never know where that takes you. And knowing that I could start that business, and well, essentially it was like a business, meant that starting Ticker was the same, just a couple more studios.
Mate, that's a great insight. And that's, you know, very inventive and creative, you know, on your front to have a crack at that. And I think I would say it, regardless of whether that had worked or not, and I'm glad it was successful, I would say even if that didn't work, that would have given you some great learnings and you know, taught you a bunch of great stuff.
That's
along the way,
right?
That's
what I thought when I started Ticker. Like, it was July last year, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do? And I knew that time had been coming for a little while, and time was up, and it was time to start something new. And I didn't want to go to the ABC or Channel 7 or Channel 9. I had no interest, and I didn't really want to go overseas either. And while I've been talking and having a chat and things, my heart just wasn't in it. And so when I decided one Friday night, I'm sitting on eBay with two bottles of wine in the middle of winter at home. It's about 11 o'clock. And I created basically a cart of everything that I needed to buy to start a television station from the equipment that I didn't already own. And I was just like, do I do this? Because if I do this and it fails, how embarrassing. But then I thought, if I do this and it fails, imagine A, how it looks on my CV that I tried. B, I know that I can do the technical, and the only reason it would fail is because of the business side. And who knows? Who knows who I'll attract? Who knows who will be attracted to me because I gave it a go? And I just hit buy, and then off it went. And that was the feeling that was going through my head. This wasn't a strategy. This wasn't a well-planned execution. This was just a get the stuff and then make a business plan. And if I look back at that business plan, we're all told to have a business plan, and I had to have one, but it's nothing like what Ticker is now. It was, Ticker was originally going to be a channel about aviation because that was my passion. I loved aviation news and stories about but I'd be stuffed now because there's no planes flying. So that gives you an idea of just extending it and knowing that don't make yourself too niche, but certainly be niche, but go for the biggest niches. Don't go for too small a niche.
Wow, that's awesome, mate. I love that. And you must, you know, you talked about aviation news being one of your passions. Just news in general must be a passion of yours, right? Like, let's talk about how you jumped into your career in journalism, because, you know, when I looked at your LinkedIn, you know, the first role you took was a cadet journalism role. Can you talk to us about, you know, throw us back in time a little bit? How did you get started in the world of media?
It started at a really, really young age, actually. And it was always, when I look back, linked to being an entrepreneur. So I think it was grade four when McDonald's moved into Rosebud. And that was a big deal. The peninsula had kind of nothing big like that at all. And the local council put all these restrictions on McDonald's. They couldn't have a sign. There were just so many things that they were told they're not allowed to do. And so I remember they gave us all the kids these little McDonald's visors, and I took it to school and decided in my lunch break that I would set up an entire town. So I had a McDonald's, had a TV station that happened to be Channel 7 because my mum used to watch a country practice. And I became really fascinated with television, and the local mayor became any girl that I fancied back in the day. So that's how it kind of worked. And that really taught me how TV would operate. And I just started becoming quite obsessive with television, where I would build studios at home out of crepe paper and cardboard in my bedroom. That was the Channel 7 newsroom, and on it would go. And I would just keep making it better and learn that there was just something about TV that I thought was so great. So by the time I got to secondary college, it's one thing to like TV, another work in it. Someone said, well, you better work on the English skills. So I really focused a lot on media and English and history. I was quite fascinated by them anyway, and then went into work experience. So went to the local newspaper. Would you believe I was incredibly shy back in those days? If someone walked past me and said, Aaron, how are you doing in the schoolyard? I couldn't find it within myself to say, good, how are you? I just was so shy. And that was always a really early battle against that. I mean, what kind of journalist can be shy? It's your job to knock on doors and to knock down doors. And then in broadcast, it's to talk. But I was really, really shy. I just didn't know what to say or why anyone would listen to me. And then went to the Melbourne show. My girlfriend at the time, her grandparents, pushed me into the Magic 693 caravan to meet this guy, Dennis Walter, who was the local news anchor on Win TV. And even though I was too young to do work experience, I think I was about 14, he took me in. And next thing, I'm in Ballarat for the week doing work experience, meeting all these great people and seeing how TV works in a rural little version of a Channel 9. And that was also a great formulating experience for what I would later do here. After high school, never really cared too much about high school, but did the school magazine on my own, the whole magazine in year 11 or 12. Which was a far better experience than anything I was going to be taught for what I wanted to do. And sent out 365 letters and did demo tapes and everything to every TV, radio station, newspaper I could find in the yellow pages. And they all came back with a no, except for the Winning Post, which was a horse racing newspaper, and I had no idea about horse racing. So then in September 2000, just as the Olympics were about to happen, I got a call from the editor of that local paper I had done the work experience with, who said, we got a job. You have to do everything, but we got a job for you. So I started there, and then they sold to a guy, and he basically ran the business into the ground. So after all of that excitement, after all of that energy, I end up back at Woolies packing shelves. And it was so humbling that you can go from your dream job and thinking you're on the way up to crashing again. And I was thinking this morning as I was getting ready for Ticker, if everything suddenly went backwards, I wouldn't give up. I'd just kind of think of what can I do in the meantime to get through getting to your earlier point. So after that, I started working in local radio, community radio in Melbourne as a breakfast newsreader. I was 19 with braces, so you can imagine how I sounded. After 3 months of doing that, I thought, well, I probably could make money out of this if I did it myself. So I started up in my apartment in South Yarra this radio news business called Como Network News, because I lived opposite the Como building and where Channel 10 was. And I sold it to radio stations around Victoria. So I had five or six stations and I was doing breakfast news, afternoon news. And in during the day was 2GB's Melbourne unpaid correspondent. That got me to rub shoulders with other journos at press conferences and to get audio that I was secretly using for my own bulletins later on in the day. That got the attention of 3AW. So I started getting calls from all these people who were furious that I was undercutting 3AW's prices. I found out from one radio station what AW was charging for their news service, and I charged half because I didn't need much money. So it was fine. My reporters were just mates who worked in office jobs, and I would email them a script, get them to phone me up, and I'd record their voice reports. Our state political reporter was just Dan, who worked for KPMG. That was kind of how it was. You just do what you can. And I realized that so much journalism is just people talking and having personality. So I accidentally got a job at 3AW, which I won't go into, but accidentally got a job and started there. And then I was covering the gangland wars, chased Carl Williams at one stage into a toilet block and he ran me over. It was a pretty crazy job, but a wonderfully entrepreneurial job. Got bashed by the police light on air at a student protest once, just all over the place. But also, I learned that Melbourne media is very much a club, and I didn't want to be in that club, and I didn't really fit into that club. And being an outsider who didn't grow up in the city, I never really felt like I was part of it, which again helps me with ticker. So all of those experiences, I went overseas, covered the tsunami in Thailand, just as it happened, the Asian tsunami, and then moved to London and was there when the Pope died in Rome. And so I went to Rome. It was really one of my first overseas trips. And I'm in Rome with 4 or 5 million Catholics and making sense of all that and the election of the new Pope. Then the London bombings happened and I was the first Aussie journo covering that on location, and I was up for about 4 nights without any sleep, just doing live crosses back to Australia, to Sky, to all of the 3AW, 2UEs, all those stations back in the day. And then went for an interview in London for this news channel that I had no idea anything about. I was 23, just turning 23. And at the end of this audition at APTN headquarters, this woman sits down, very, very mysterious looking woman with a thick Russian accent, and she says, "How would you feel about moving to Moscow?" And I was like, I've always wanted to live in Russia, and I'm kind of thinking anything I can about Russia. And I'm thinking, well, I love vodka and I love James Bond, and he's always against the Russians, but at least that gives me something. And a week later, I'm moving to Russia with 80 other British and American journos, and off I go in Moscow. So I was there for 10 freezing months. I had minus 37 for 3 months of the year. And then my mum had a baby when I was 24. And I came back, was flying through Sydney, and Sky offered me a job, again, just by chance. And I was there for 13 years.
Wow. I don't know where to start on there. Yeah. That is an amazing journey. That's got a bit of everything,
that's
right?
That's very much the abridged version of how it happened.
100%, mate. But
the extraordinary experiences that I'm kind of casting over. Like, I go to these parties, mate, in Moscow. I very quickly got invited as a 23-year-old to all these different incredible parties in with the expat who work for embassies. So they're Canadian, American, British, New Zealand, Australian, and they all hang out with each other. And they all get these fabulous apartments in these beautiful Russian buildings. And every weekend someone would have a party. And you'd have Russian ministers, spies, CNN anchors. It was incredible what you would see, the conversations you would have. And so when I came back to Melbourne, I was so flat. I was like, what am I doing back here? Like, there is a whole world going on out there. And yet here, if it's not footy, we don't want to know about it. And it was really, really, really challenging when I came back home.
Oh, no doubt, mate. And yeah, that journey, and I know that's just a snapshot. I'd love to hear about every party, every lesson, every up and down you had. But there's a lot in there, that mate. That, you know, you're obviously very opportunistic. You know, I guess the good thing about news and the good thing about, you know, wanting to be a journalist is that there's always something to cover, something to talk about, a story to tell, etc. Sometimes they're massive, you know, world headline news, and other times, you know, you've got to find the story and be creative to find that.
I think what happens, if I can just jump in there, is that we have a mistake in humanity of always trying to find comfort. And to find comfort means that you try to resist change when it happens or you're surprised by it. And over all of those years of covering stories, of going to bed and not knowing where I'm going to be the next day, like I've literally woken up in Melbourne, gone to work and then gone to sleep in Paris. Like, and you didn't know that was going to happen. You just get a call saying you're off in an hour, you're on a plane. And that means that I suppose it breaks you down. Nothing ever feels familiar. And you realize that when something like COVID-19 happens, you just see it as a cycle. It becomes another kind of way of dealing with things. And yeah, it has long lasting effects, don't get me wrong, but you also realize that everything is an opportunity. And if you can learn from it, stay relevant, and I hate to use the word agile, but just what you did yesterday should not be what you do today. And it's the same as your exercise regime, right? You don't want to just go for a 5K run for the rest of your life. You want to break it up a bit because you never know when your body's going to tell you you can't. And if you're so used to something, it'll be so much more of a shock when you can no longer do that thing. So I think our whole society is being shocked into trying new things. Yeah. And that is really, really great to be a great time to start a business.
Yeah, with the benefit of hindsight, would that be the advice or the the learnings that you'd give your younger self if you went back to, you know, those late teens, early 20s, or advice you'd give someone now that's just starting to get into, you know, journalism and content creation? Would that be the advice you'd shared? Is, you know, don't worry about tomorrow, there's always something gonna happen?
My advice would also be don't look for a full-time job. I know that sounds right, the opposite of what we've been told. But I think that our reliance on a full-time job actually holds us back. And I had people saying this to me when I was at Sky. Why are you still there? You're so loyal all the time. Why are you so loyal to these companies? And I was like, well, because I'll be loyal back. And the reality is no company is loyal anymore. No one is loyal to anyone anymore. It's just how it is. There are so many other things that are completely out of our own or their own doing that these days companies are looking after the future of their companies. That's how it works, not necessarily the loyalty of their staff. So I think that number one, I would tell myself, stop panicking, everything will be okay. Yep. It's so easy to become anxious when you're outside of it and you think that it's always gonna be like this. Where I was last year, looking at starting a business and thinking, oh my God, I don't know about so many things. It was so overwhelming. Imagine you've got the business side and then you've got the graphic side, the content side, the staffing side, the where are you going to do your office location side. There are so many things, but again, that view of you get through it, you just do one thing at a time. I think that is the advice that I would love to have given myself. I grew up on the Mornington Peninsula. As much as I love the beach, I was always frustrated by the isolation of growing up down there. And I would imagine just standing on a rock, you know, looking up in the sky, thinking one day there'll be studio lights, but I'll never get there. Well, I wish I could go back to that 14-year-old and say, enjoy the bloody beach, you idiot. Like, you're not going to get to the beach as often as you get older. You're there. You've got this amazing experience. Right now, I can't drive to that beach. Like, you just never know what's going to be around the corner. You might end up in a wheelchair. You might end up in some. So just enjoy where you're at. Enjoy what you've got. Because, and make the best use of it, because if you're always wanting to be somewhere else, you'll never get there. You'll never be happy. My greatest test for how happy I am I drinking too much? Then I'm probably not too happy. Or if I go on a holiday, and while I'm on the holiday, I'm still bored and I'm saying to myself, I need to go on a holiday, and I'm on the holiday, there must be something going on that you've got to deal with. And that's why we started the show, 30 Life Crisis, for people who are doing something in the anxiety and the Sunday night, they're sitting at home thinking, I hate the idea of waking up tomorrow. Or they're going to bed at 1 a.m. because they don't want to go to bed at 10 because they don't want to wake up in the morning. They want to try and enjoy their free time as much as they can. Do we want to live like that? I mean, is that, I don't know. I know that people in the past have gone through world wars and we're pretty lucky to have a job, right? But I just think that your own personal happiness and getting rid of that anxiety and making sure that you are kind of having a goal but not necessarily sticking to it perfectly, that surely is a bit better. That's my view.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, mate. And you know, one of the reasons I started this podcast was, you know, I really don't think there's that one job that everyone should have to attain to only. I think life is full of dream jobs. You know, like you, I've had multiple roles where some were long tenures and others were short. And I love them equally for different reasons. I believe that even through those different roles, the necessities that I was going through changed and altered and switched each time as well, that helped me drive whether that was a dream job for me at that particular time and whether it wasn't tomorrow, et cetera.
Well, circumstances change, right? So at one stage, in my 20s, it was so much fun to be here, there and everywhere.
Yeah.
But then I remember looking back at the start of last year, and I'm still living in a one-bedroom apartment. And the number one thing I'm proud of is the size of my television and how good my suitcase is, because I need it to have a mobile phone charger in it so that I'm never without mobile phone as I'm flying around the world. But the things that I also love, like having a dog, having a stable relationship, I didn't have.
Yeah.
And as you move through your life, things change. That excitement of seeing the world gets replaced with, well, I love a Labrador now. I'd love to have that sense of loyalty and friendship. And to be able to change your job, because quite often it's your job that prevents you from having a job, or it's your job that means you need to live in a certain place. So as you start to look around and say, gosh, it'd be nice to not live in a one-bedroom apartment anymore, you realize it, well, I live right next to the city. I can only afford a one-bedroom apartment. So if you want to change your life, sometimes you have to change your job.
Oh, 100%. You've got to be ready for that next opportunity, which is the goal thing. And yeah, one of the key reasons I wanted to speak with you, because I really love some of the sort of initiatives that you list out for Ticker, and I loved a couple of the quotes you use across the website and a few of your socials. And if you're the creative guy, they probably come from you. The first quote that I really liked was Ticker isn't for the CEO; it's for the people who work for the CEO and one day want to be a CEO. What's behind that?
Well, again, it's the us and them mentality. It's that kind of view that an organization, and the Japanese are actually the worst at this, would you believe, in that they have this real sense of you are up here and you are down here. And I think that as much as I admire capitalism, capitalism tries to stop capitalism from happening, which is the whole thing is about change, and the whole thing is about being able to rise up and to be able to say, I'm not happy with these circumstances, things need to change. Right through history, that's what has happened. The work boot has always in the end beaten the UGG boot. And to make sure that the workers in an organization are being allowed to feel like what they are saying is important to me is really important. Now, all companies need leaderships, but to think that only leaders know what's truly best for a company, I haven't seen that in my journey. I haven't seen that. I've always felt like there's another alternative or there's another way. And if the company has listened a little bit more to what the people on the ground are experiencing rather than a top-down approach, I think that companies would do a lot better. Well, what I loved about Skype was so entrepreneurial, and our CEO Angela would always say, we're a little bit like the mosquito that just is constantly on the ABC. And I love that, like that via that view of, as much as I respect the ABC, they're like the Titanic. They can't move quickly when something's there because there's just too many parts to move. But if your organization is agile, if you make your staff feel like their viewpoint on the organization is as important as the CEO's, then I think that the CEO, A, becomes a better person. The CEO is more agile, is more in tune with people. And I just also think that we want people to feel like they're able to shift and to be able to change as well as much as they can.
Yeah, that's great, man. And the best CEOs I've seen are ones that foster that kind of culture with their staff from top to bottom, not even just from their leadership team, but top to bottom. And then also,
but I think it's the same when businesses grow, they start to lose that. Like there's this view from a CEO that I'm too busy to know what's happening on the ground now. I'm too busy. I'm flying here. I'm flying there. I don't know what's going on. You start to rely on these people who come up with the dreadful title of middle management. And middle management, I always refer to as Janet. And Janet's always someone who's come up and doesn't quite want to be in that role and loses the respect of the people that she used to work with and will never have the respect of the people above her, even though she desperately wants to be one of them. I have seen that with my own eyes.
Yep.
And that kind of organization, I think at a time like what we're going through right now, it just doesn't work.
Exactly right. And your audience, you know, will likely skew a bit younger because of statements like that. You know, I saw another quote that I loved, the Netflix of news. And I know that you're going for sort of that under 50 kind of age group, right? And I don't know whether you've zeroed in even tighter than that on a certain age group target, have you?
Funny you say that. I'll give you a bit of insight here.
Yeah.
It was going to be under 40s network. And then I realized I'm 37 and this might take a bit longer than 3 years to get right. So it became under 45s. Sure, as I hit 44, it'll be an under 50s network. But have you ever met someone over 45 who hasn't felt under 45? Because I never have. They may look in the mirror and see someone that they don't necessarily recognize anymore, but they still feel young. They still feel full of energy. And to be able to, we have a lot of shows hosted by people who are well over 45,
yep.
But they talk to others who are over 45 in the same way that they have that energy, that youth, and it's about changing the mentality. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about under 45s, we only say that because in many ways, under 45s haven't set themselves in for the rest of their lives, are willing to change, are willing to take risk. And what I love about Ticker is we have hosts who talk to people who are over 45 about how they took risk. The average age of an entrepreneur in this country isn't 18 or 20 like you might think it is. It's 52.
Yeah.
It's people who have gone through business, been turfed out the other side through redundancies or just they're not needed anymore. And that's when they recreate their entire lives. So that's the person we talk to. That's the person we want to help. That's the person that we all will one day become, because we have an aging population. We have a service culture now as opposed to a manufacturing society and economy. And we have a lot of people who, a lot of businesses who are moving to a casual workforce instead of a full-time workforce because they don't know what's around the corner. So you've got to be able to start your own business.
That's great, mate. And I know that you definitely, in the original state, I read that you wanted to really, consider and present tech and digital at the forefront of what you do, which is obviously important because you're an online platform and you've made moves, obviously getting onto Apple TV and the Google network, etc. My audience, as I build it, will be that kind of, career mover, career changer, in many instances, a graduate or student. I want them to be learning. Like, that's the biggest advice I want to pass on, is that there's always a learning opportunity, no matter what day it is, no matter what year you are in your career. Like, what key things do you want your audience to learn from Ticker as you build the business?
Well, I'll go back a little bit. When the NBN was first announced, remember how dreadful the internet was? I've always been an early adopter of technology. Before Apple TV, I used to have a Sony PlayStation where you could download videos or movies from the Sony PlayStation store. And on a Friday night, I'd be so proud of this. I'd have my 3G wireless router going and I'd have my mates come over. But annoyingly, I lived next to the MCG and it would take about 13 hours to download the first 5 minutes of a movie. And so I realized that when the NBN came through, what was going to happen, and I could literally see this, was the democratization of the entire media industry. So why would you bother having a tower on Mount Dandenong or in Willoughby in Sydney, broadcasting this old-fashioned 1920s technology signal where now everyone can upload and download 5 HD signals at once using the NBN. Whether the NBN turned out to be that good, who knows. Regardless of that, if you have a look back at the last couple of years, the TV networks have been doing massive write-downs of the value of their broadcasting license. And that just sums up what I think. Pretty soon, well, in Germany right now, they've begun trials of broadcasting their TV networks only on 5G, so shutting down the traditional towers. So therefore, the one thing that they always had over us going out the window, then you have a look at your own personal behavior. My TV is only ever on HDMI 1. I don't even know where the remote is to be able to go back to channel 7 or 9. If I want to watch 7 or 9, I need to watch 7 plus or 9 now and go through that horrible activation thing that they have. But you do it if you really want to watch it. So that means that the Ticker app on my Apple TV sits next to the Channel 9 app on my Apple TV, and it doesn't change. And that's where we're going. That's what's going to happen. So therefore, it becomes about your brand. And obviously Channel 9's brand has been around forever, but I really watched and I hate to be critical, but if you watch these massive media mergers of, say, Nine buying Fairfax so they get access to The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Well, that's great while they're printing newspapers, but what happens in a couple of years' time, or even now, where they go, we can't do this anymore. There's been talk for ages of The Age and the SMH would go to like a Monday hard copy paper and a Sunday hard copy paper because they lose money every other day of the week. So when that happens, The Age just becomes a brand on the internet and the SMH just becomes a brand on the internet. We know these brands because we grew up with them, but the next generation, what's it going to mean to them? It's just another internet source of news. And then Nine ends up owning both of those brands as well as having the Channel 9 News brand online that they're pumping out. You see on their microphones, they've got the 9news.com.au. It's in the bottom of the corner. So they're actually now competing against their own online entity. My fear is over time, these brands will also disappear. They just won't matter to people anymore. So instead of buying a company for $2 billion, just so you can get access to a brand that I think in a couple of years will be 20 people in an office in Sydney, 20 people in an office in Melbourne, no back end. That's what we're all moving towards.
Yep.
Well, I want to start a business that's where they're going.
Yeah.
And that's how I look at it. So low overheads, what you see is what there is. Ticker is a Hollywood set. All you see is all there is.
Yeah.
That's how business has to be. Why would you have 100 people behind the scenes when you can't, when people are choosing your channel for your content?
Yeah.
So it's not that I want anyone to lose their jobs. I'm just trying to reflect in my business what my own human nature is and what I'm seeing.
That's awesome, mate. And look, for a journalist student out there right now listening to this, or anyone in in media, maybe sick of their current role, as Ticker grows, and as the platform, which is exciting, it's an exciting business model, and I wish you nothing but luck with it. But as it grows and builds, and I guess you take on more opportunity and more staff and more people being able to work with you, what should someone do? How does someone reach out to you guys? How does someone show their interest to work with you in the future?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. We just went through a process where I realized we needed a social media person to be dedicated to going through all of our so many shows, cutting up the best bits, putting them out on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook and YouTube and all of the different deals, because every show has a different deal that we've negotiated, and that's the person that needs to do it. It was just kind of getting a little bit beyond us. I'm looking at the other side of this computer at a wall that now has 7 hours of content 5 days a week, and every show is different, and every show has its own personality and its own opener. If I had stuck to, and this was a funny thing, at Sky, I'd been doing everything. So reporter, even built the sets at one stage in Melbourne and Sydney, and Perth, was managing staff. I was in Afghanistan reporting with the Australian Army as an embed, getting calls from the accounts department saying, why haven't you done this week's rosters? And so the thing was being an all-rounder was so important. And the reason I'm going and telling you this is because when we went through this process of hiring a social media person, all I was getting was emails from people who could do social media. And the problem with that is that no small business these days can survive with one person who can do one thing. The person we ended up choosing is actually someone we already knew. We knew her work ethic. We knew that she was a great person. We knew that she was never going to be a problem on the team. We knew that she fit in with us. We fit in with her. We'd have to adjust our behavior because we're three guys and we're about to bring a girl into the team. And I wanted that. I wanted to make sure that this was a team that wasn't just three blokes sitting around having a yak, that it was actually much, much more than that, and that we could be open to anyone joining the team. And I think a lot of startups make that mistake where they become too male-centric. And they don't move away from that. So I wanted us as quickly as we could to get away from that. And Alana became the right person. She was a host and she had been working on this show called The Big Day about weddings. And we had a business model for that show that did not work. And after a week, she came back and said, hey, this just ain't gonna work. So we quickly came up with a new one. She went out, sold that, had four shows in the can. And then coronavirus hits. And how can you do a show about weddings? So we parked that and she emailed me and said, look, I've just lost my other job. I don't know what to do. And just as I was about to go through my, I think we got about 600 resumes from my one call out on LinkedIn. And what do 600 resumes mean to me? How do I do anyone justice? How is anyone better than anyone else? So I went with the devil I knew. I went with the person who I had the relationship with. I went for the person who showed me that they were willing to change in a crisis or when things didn't work well. When Jen and I were building the studio, the other studio was still going in our old premises, and we were at Bunnings, and this notification comes through on my Instagram, and it's this shoot happening at this premises, and it's a wedding premises. And I'm like, did you know that there was a film shoot happening today on location? He's like, it must be the wedding show. And Alana had just taken the nous to go out and shoot the show herself because the studio was busy at the time. I can't describe a better resume than that.
Yeah, gotcha.
It's not just what I've done in the past, but how will I deal with your business right now? So don't come to me via email. Come to me as a person. Build up a rapport. Show me that you're someone who's human and show me that you're keen and that you're a great person. Don't tell me it. Show it.
That's great, mate. That's great advice. That's a really good insight. So lesson learned. And I'm going to wrap this up, mate. I really appreciate your time. I'm going to finish with, we do a listener question of the week. And this is probably from a media student. This is a guy named Troy. So Troy has asked, what is the biggest achievement or mistake you made in your early career that you learned the most from? And you've had a diverse career. I'll give you a second to think about it. You've had plenty of different jobs. You've had some amazing opportunities, obviously. Biggest career achievement, early career achievement, or biggest mistake that you learned something from?
That is such a great question. And there is like 20 trillion things running through my head right now of great disasters and great moments where things have worked out. And it's very hard to choose one specific. I think of the time where I've made terrible mistakes in reporting that were never deliberate, but because I didn't know the rules. For example, reporting that someone had died before the family member had been told. I didn't know that that was the case. And I still think about it to this day. Like, you as a journalist have nightmares about the times that it goes wrong. Yeah. But so long as you're having the nightmares, I think that's what's so important. So long as you're still being taken back to the lesson that you learn. And that is the greatest achievement, is to learn from a shocking time that is emotionally impacting and to make sure that it never happens again, that you become stronger and better for it, and also that you talk to people about it when they're about to go through the same thing. In our office, I've got a lot of young people who I work with, and you assume knowledge, you assume that they know what you know, and I quite often have to go, you know, it becomes Aaron's story time when I say, look, this happened, this exact situation happened, and I went down the exact path you're about to go down, and this is what I learned out of it. So it's funny, the number one thing that comes to mind that was a disaster was when the tsunami happened, and I could just sense that this was going to be a big Australian story. The ABC had someone over in Thailand, in Tong Beach, where, as we know, a lot of Australians go holidaying in Tong, and we had no one. And I went to my news director and said, we need to do this. And he was on holiday. It was that time of year when everyone was on holiday. But the station manager or the program director didn't want me to go, didn't want anyone to go, didn't want to spend any money. That's what it came down to. So eventually the news director won out. I had to go speak to the program director, and I have never been spoken to the way that he spoke to me. He called me every name under the sun because his authority had been challenged. So then I'm going to the, I went and got my shots, and I go to the airport, and I'm on this 9-hour Thai Airways flight. I've never felt more anxious. Like, I just thought, if this doesn't, it was my first overseas trip ever. I'd never even been on a holiday, and I'm going to a disaster zone, being basically told, if this doesn't work, you're finished. Your entire career is finished. And I worked 23 hours a day for 4 days, right? Just kept filing reports, was working off that sense of, I'm screwed if this doesn't work. So I wasn't looking after myself at all. And at one stage I fell asleep and turn my mobile off, and the hotel phone rings, and it's that program director saying, you're not there to sleep, you're there to work, get back. So I got back, and I got to the end of it after 2 weeks, came home, and he sent a fax from his office, which is just over there, to the newsroom saying, Aaron, well done. Now, you could say that that was a huge disaster. It was not a great time to go through, But what a great lesson about how your managers don't actually know better than you a lot of the time. And you have to stick with your gut sometimes and really push because it's the right thing. We won awards for that. We became well-respected for that. I became respected for that. And the network won awards for sending people over there. And they ended up sending other journos to Arche and the other hotspots. Your managers don't always know better than you. They don't always have the answers. And that to me is, from a very young age, was a real moment for me of that I've carried through for the rest of my career. And now that I'm in a management role, I feel the same. There'll be a little Aaron who'll come along one day and teach me something I don't know and I need to be prepared for it.
That's awesome, Aaron. And maybe that little Aaron's Troy. So I wish Troy the best with his studies. You might see him behind the on the ticker screens in no time at all. Hey, mate, I've really enjoyed this chat. Thank you so much for coming on Dream Job Ready. I wish you nothing but success with Ticker. I'll be continuing to watch, mate. There's plenty to talk about for you guys right now. And, thanks again for joining me.
Yeah, and congrats to you and your new family as well. I know that's an amazing skill. I hope that I'm now in a position where I can now run a business and have a family, which feels like the first time I've been able to say that my whole life. So change your job and sometimes it can change your life.
No, it's great to be busy. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thanks so much.